And I would say that in this regard, the hospitalist and the emergency physician maybe are coming at this from the same place, in the sense that in many hospitals now, I've noticed that it's the hospitalist who's sort of responsible for the TPA decision in conjunction with the emergency physician, or is responsible for admitting that patient after they've been evaluated and treated.
Sure.
So I think, you know, the first and foremost, the issue is providing resources at the bedside that can support the practice of that first responding physician if they're not a stroke expert. So ideally you'd love a stroke expert, you know, from your own hospital at your bedside, guiding the decision-making process. And that's, I think, present in only a rare handful of, you know, the sort of tertiary academic or very, highly developed community hospital setting. But that for many practices, it's a physician over the telephone, often a neurologist who specializes in stroke, but sometimes just a neurologist who maybe spends most of their time, you know, doing neuromuscular disease or dementia or whatever. And that for far too many, it's nobody willing to come along and help support that decision. So I think part of the reason for underutilization of intravenous TPA is the lack of available expertise supplied in a way that provides the first responding physician, you know, emergency physician or hospitalist, with the kind of trust and confidence that they need to administer the drug.
So someone who knows what they're doing is willing to say, yes, let's do this. It just isn't available too often.
Let's us do this, not, yeah, you can go ahead and give it, but I'll never see you again.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, you can go ahead and give it based on the information you gave me. So if there's ever a problem, I'm going to say, well, you know, the emergency physician told me that there was no, decreased level of consciousness, or based on what he reported to me as his exam. So it's all very arm's length, which is, maybe feels better for the consultant, but doesn't feel so good for the person standing by the side of the bed. And so I think what happens in those environments is that the emergency physicians generally tend to call and treat the patients who are really obviously having a stroke, and in whom, the impairment is more than mild and less than really severe. So they're kind of picking the sweet spot.
Sure.
Tennis racket.
Sure.
So in response to that, as you, come to recognize, this whole sort of drip and ship phenomenon started where hospitals that were previously receiving a lot of patients that had been evaluated at a smaller facility were being transferred in having received no treatment, and by the time they arrived at the major medical center had often missed the window of opportunity for intravenous TPA, and were getting a lot of unproven catheter-based treatments.
Yeah.
Unproven and unapproved.
And not the ideal that we would want for someone who is within the window.
Right, and just this, as is true with thrombolysis for acute MI, early treatment has been shown to be better.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is really a golden hour. It's, you know, 1.9 million neurons are dying every minute of ischemia. And even though we have, you know, billions of nerve cells, we don't really want to give away 2 million of them every minute.
Yeah.
So the real question then becomes, what's the best way to support a practitioner at the bedside? And clearly being there in person is ideal. If you can't be there in person, what's better? A telephone call to someone who carries the Board of Neurology and Psychiatry after their name but doesn't necessarily do stroke all the time, or a stroke expert available by interactive video conferencing who can view the images, you know, examine the patient and share in the responsibility of decision making? I think the answer is, and people seem to be voting with their feet, the answer is they'd rather have a specialist there by video if they can do it in a simple and easy way.
Yeah.
So the big difference now, I think, and sort of the heart of our conversation comes, well, what's the best way to do that? And you could imagine that there are several possible responses to that. One would be to say, hey, I don't need any neurologists other than what I already have at my hospital. I'm just going to make it easy for them so they don't have to drive in at night. They can just connect via the video. So that's one approach.
Okay.
Another approach would be to say, you know what, I don't have enough neurology coverage here, and the neurologists I do have really are not, you know, either expert in this or invested in this. I want to link myself to anybody, I don't care who they are or where they are, I just want a neurologist, as soon as I need one, who will show up on the camera in my ER. And I don't need to ever see them again. I just want it once. I don't care where they're from. I just want to cover this transaction. So that's what I refer to in my email to you as sort of transactional telemedicine.
All right.
So the advantage of that is it brings expertise immediately, but it brings it outside the context of a comprehensive or tertiary stroke care center with which a relationship will be built over time. It's really a very much a one-off transactional exchange where even if the patient got treated and, let's say, stayed at the remote hospital, if there was a complication or a question, the next time you call, you get someone different.
Yeah.
You don't get the same person again. And so I think that's a very abstract generalization from the approach that has been used successfully and from which the data have been derived, which is more of this hub and spoke model. Telemedicine merely is another form of glue that helps to connect primary stroke centers of lesser capability to more advanced centers, and provides for a sort of an escalating chain of access to resources depending on the patient's needs. So it may be a simple phone call which says, you know, he just started on dialysis, can he get TPA? And the answer is, well, maybe not. Or, you know, he just, you know, had cardiac surgery 2 weeks ago. Is that an exclusion? Yes, that's an exclusion.
Yeah.
You may be done. Or it may be, I have a case, can you help me with it? Yes, okay, we treat the IV TPA. It's relatively mild symptoms. I think we can manage them here. Terrific. We'll call you back tomorrow if we have any questions. Not a problem here, by the way. You also want to, you know, get an echo and, you know, make sure there's no carotid injury, XYZ. To the more severe stroke, or we don't really have capability here, we'd like to transfer that patient to Mass General. So not only do you get the transactional piece of you get your stroke coverage when you need it, you get knowledge transfer because now maybe it's the fifth or the sixth time that you have consulted with me and you're getting this consistent message and understanding of how to work up stroke. But you're also getting this relationship with MGH. And these kind of networks often do a lot of collateral teaching. So when you're bringing up a site, there's a lot of effort that goes into creating a stroke team at the site. There's effort that goes into having ongoing continuing medical education that gets pushed out through these networks. We have a grand rounds over the telemedicine network every month or so, which is highly attended by our spoke sites as a way to get stroke-related continuing medical education, which they need for certification and also for engaging their clinical staff. There are two key philosophical principles. One is, you know, you use the technology that you need for that transaction. So if it's a question that can be answered simply over the telephone, that's all you use. You don't have to go to video just because you have it. You do it if you need it. Like, you know, if you have a stethoscope and an ultrasound machine, you don't have to go to the ultrasound machine if the stethoscope answers your question.
Right.
So, but the typical consultation begins with a page through our paging system, a quick telephone conversation to ascertain, you know, the nature of the consult and whether the patient seems like they're likely to require an evaluation. If they do, then a video conferencing link is established, and at the same time, the CT scan acquired on the patient, or in some cases the MRI, but almost always a non-contrast CT scan, is pushed from the remote hospital through a secure link to a server that lives inside our firewall. So all studies aggregate inside our firewall at a specific location. Our stroke physician might be in the office, they might be in the ICU, they might be at home, wherever they are. They link into a central video conferencing switch, which allows them to connect not only to the remote hospital, but also to a fellow, an acute stroke fellow in the hospital. And if appropriate, some form of trainee or observer or other consultant if that was necessary. All of that is digitally recorded for quality purposes and with the permission of the patient if acquired for also research and teaching purposes. The patient is examined over the video, with the examination being led by the neurologist expert and requiring some assistance from a bedside assistant. That might be the nurse, might be a PA, it might be the emergency physician or the hospitalist. It really depends on the needs and the interest at the remote site in terms of, you know, how busy the people are and what else is going on in the area at that time. This is relevant for both inpatients as well as patients presenting to the emergency department. After the data's been gathered, then there's a conversation with the patient and or family, or legally authorized caregivers, and a decision is made collaboratively with the emergency physician or other remote physician about whether thrombolytic therapy is indicated and what the appropriate disposition of the patient might be, whether it's to stay at that hospital, to transfer to a different hospital, to transfer to one of our academic medical centers, the MGH or the Brigham, and whether they're a candidate for further thrombolytic intervention with a catheter, for example, with an FDA-approved device or enrollment in a clinical trial. So within MGH, and we have partnered with the Brigham and Women's Hospital, which is our sort of sister flagship hospital.
All right.
So they actually serve part of the population of hospitals we serve in another part, and we cross-cover each other so that if one of us is overflowed, we can send patients to the other one.
All right.
So clearly and critical to this operation is a clinical champion within neurology, within the stroke service. That's me at the Mass General.
All right.
And I have a counterpart at the Brigham.
All right.
Clear and critically involved in this process is someone from the IT world, so an information technology champion. In some hospitals, that's the person who is responsible both for video conferencing capabilities, if they have a developed program, and sort of IT security, information technology management. In our hospital, that's two different groups.
Okay.
So we have someone engaged from the video conferencing side of things, and we have someone engaged from the networking and security aspects. I think that's a bare minimum.
All right.
You also, if you're a spoke, you need to have somebody in the emergency department who's your clinical champion as opposed to your vascular neurologist, but the clinical role shifts. But you still need someone supporting this initiative in the information technology zone who's going to support the video connection as well as sending CT images and making sure that you can access the resources that you...
Okay. And you provide some guidance to them in terms of what they need to do to be able to operate as a spoke on this
exactly.
Network.
We do actually a fair amount of training.
Yeah.
To help them execute that. So we've spent much of the past several years developing training materials and standardizing our processes so that we can bring a spoke site up. Now, usually within 6 to 8 weeks, we can get a spoke up and running if they can hit the milestones related to technology.
Okay.
And the other piece is that under me, we have someone who really manages sort of the business operation of getting contracts signed, managing the relationship with the hospitals, navigating all the sort of bureaucratic functions. We have two programmers and sort of systems engineers who help maintain the network, testing, maintenance, training the sites, interfacing with the IT folks, doing all that outreach, and keeping our web space up to date so that it serves the function that we need. And then we hire one person full-time who does nothing, well, not does nothing, but whose main job is focusing around licensure and credentialing.
Okay.
Which is a huge, huge barrier that still exists. This is not a game to play casually.
Okay.
Is what I would say. Yes, I think this is really about developing new healthcare delivery models, and it has lots of complicated factors that need to be addressed for the experience to be predictable and successful, and I think it's something that sites should strongly consider investing in, because I do think that there's going to be a lot of healthcare provided through this channel in the future, but it's not something to think that you can just pick up and do without a lot of forethought, and I think that would be my main caution to people is think about this carefully before you step into it. The technology is actually the least challenging of the whole thing. It's not the technology, it's integrating people into delivering care in this new way that is the challenge. And I think that organizations need to recognize that while it's very attractive to plunk down a big amount of capital to purchase some fancy technology equipment, it's really the people they should be investing in more than the technology. Yeah, I think, so let me say three things. Number one, there are a lot of information channels that I think people should be kind of picking up on, and I just partnered with a group from a company called Quantia Medical. Okay. Quantia MD, they're like a, they're an information provider that streams content to websites, cell phones, and they have a lot of hospitalists actually in their user base. And we just did a whole series about acute stroke care there. So that would be an easy place for a lot of your community to go look because they're already members. So that's the first thing I would say is there's a lot of material out there now. I think the thing that hospitalists need to know is, number one, stroke care is coming under much greater scrutiny. It's now part of the Joint Commission core measure set, and the indication from CMS is that it will soon be part of required hospital reporting for all inpatients. The second thing is that there really is a bundle, just like there's a ventilator bundle, there's a bundle of things you should do for every stroke patient. And those are the basis on which the performance measures are based. And there's really an opportunity now to identify and pick a national quality improvement program for stroke care and participate. So I would say there's Get With The Guidelines Stroke from the American Heart Association. There's the Paul Coverdell National Acute Stroke Registry from the CDC. And there's the Joint Commission Primary Stroke Center Program. Each one of those, there's a lot of overlap between them, provides the structure for improving quality of stroke care. And it's really, I think, you know, it's money very well spent by the hospital. These are not expensive programs. The tools are very useful.